Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Stephen Flanagan, Senior Vice President here at CSIS and holder of the Kissinger Chair, and it's a pleasure to welcome you to this event, the launch of our new study on pursuing the comprehensive vision of the U.S.-South Korea alliance. This has been a project almost a year now in making, about 10 months of active effort and research, and so we're delighted to have this opportunity. And of course, as we'll try to steer clear of current news, but Korea is always on our mind. But we're trying to look longer term today, and that really is the purpose of this effort and this report. And I'll just say a few words about the origins of this study and how it was pursued, and then turn the floor over to our lead investigator and principal author, Scott Snyder. And then commentary by Michael Finnegan. But let me just say a word also of welcome. This project has been graciously sponsored by the Korea Foundation, and I believe that Ms. Soo Ahn-jeong is in the audience with us today, or we're expecting her shortly if she isn't here. But anyway, so we do want to thank the Korea Foundation for their support of this project, and also I'll thank a number of the representatives of the Embassy of the Republic of Korea here in Washington, and the embassy and a number of their officers have been very helpful to us in the conduct of this work, as have been both officials at the U.S. Embassy, Seoul, U.S. Forces Korea, and a number of other interlocutors, and some of whom you'll see are mentioned in the back of this book. And let me also, and I'll mention them as I talk a little bit about the structure of this report and the structure of this project. This was an effort to seize up what we saw as a moment in time, a moment of opportunity, with two transitions coming, one that had already begun in the Republic of Korea, but one that was on the horizon in the United States. And the notion that while there had been a great deal of progress made in the last several years in updating and adapting the U.S.-ROK alliance relationship, there was still a feeling that there was a need for Ms. Soo is joining us now, I think, there. There was a feeling that a great deal of progress had been made in adapting particularly the military dimensions of the alliance relationship through the Future of the Alliance talks, the Strategic Policy Initiative, and other efforts then extending over into the foreign affairs side of discussions and setting forward a broader vision. But there were clearly expressions of interest on the part of both the NOAK government in the ROK, even before Lee Myung-bak came to power, of this idea that there could be a broader, a more comprehensive vision of this alliance, and that the alliance had really, even though it was still very much focused on job one, which was deterring any kind of conflict and preventing a conflict on the Korean Peninsula, but that there was this broader set of issues, and already that the U.S. and the ROK were cooperating on a much wider range of issues, and of course the enormity of the economic relationship, other aspects of the relations that needed to be explored, and to think about how would you set this broader comprehensive framework for bilateral cooperation and getting into areas that were still where there was not yet quite consensus to move ahead on. And I don't want to get into some of the things that Scott is going to touch on, but clearly other areas of cooperation that we were not quite ready to engage in a formal way within alliance discussions, but obviously a number of regional issues of global challenges, including aspects of nonproliferation, of regional, various natural disasters, of dealing with climate change, of dealing with the potential for other natural disasters in the region that might warrant a combined U.S.-ROK approach, and perhaps also working with others. In any event, so there was a feeling that there really needed to be a more systematic effort to, first of all, to look backwards and assess in a balanced way, in a way that CSIS has been known for over the years, of looking back at what was the state of the core elements of the alliance, what had been achieved, but then to also look forward and to look at both current and emerging missions where the alliance partners were already engaged in cooperation, where there was potential to undertake even broader cooperation, and how could that be best realized and orchestrated, and what kinds of mechanisms might be needed, what kinds of consultative processes might be desirable to undertake that. So we convened here at CSIS a group, and we designated Scott Snyder, who I'll now begin to introduce as both a senior associate of the CSIS Pacific Forum, and, of course, he has been most recently a director of the Center for U.S.-Korea Policy and senior associate of the Washington Programs of the Asia Foundation. We enlisted Scott to be as a principal investigator to work in developing this and reviewing these other missions that the alliance might undertake, or areas where alliance cooperation might be more effectively focused. And working together with my former colleague Derek Mitchell, who has gone off and is now, of course, Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs. For East Asia and in the what used to be called International Security Affairs, but in the East Asia part of that. Michael Green, who's a senior advisor here and also head of the Japan program. Nicholas Cheney, who's a Deputy Director of the Japan Chair and also a research fellow. And myself served as a group of senior advisors to that to Scott in the conduct of this work, and ably assisted by our research coordinator Allison Slack, who pulled all this together. So over the course of several months, a number of us assisted Scott in both the conduct of his research and his efforts to suss out some of these specific elements of emerging alliance cooperation. And we were also very happy to then enlist a number of not only senior officials and former officials of both the U.S. and the ROK government, some of whom, most of whom are mentioned in the back of this report in the appendices. But also, we were very fortunate to have, and a number of them are in the audience today. We had a series of roundtables here, here in Washington, to review various drafts of Scott's report. As it was emerging, and so I want to thank some of them. And in particular, I see Paul Chamberlain here, and I think I don't know if I'm missing any, but Chaz Freeman was very helpful to us in a series of other discussions we had in Seoul about some of the elements of this. So we thank him as well. But there are a number of other people that certainly we are grateful to. And Scott, I know may want to say a word himself about that, but. So that the various iterations of the report were then, given this additional perspective, and particularly it was important given that, we were looking at some areas where there has not been a long tradition of U.S. ROK bilateral cooperation to gain these perspectives of a wide circle of people, including in the economics area and some other aspects of global health and other transnational and global challenges that are not the mainstay of discussions of the U.S. ROK relationship. So that's probably enough about the context of this. And as I say, and Scott will now outline some of the framework that he has developed. Let me just say a word then of introduction to him. You have short bios in some of the program announcement of both Scott and Michael Finnegan. But as I mentioned, he has been Scott has been serving in the last several years here in the Washington office of the Asia Foundation, and previously he had been a country representative of the Asia Foundation in Korea between 2000 and 2004. Prior to that, he was, of course, an Asia specialist in research studies in the Research and Studies Program of the U.S. Institute of Peace, and he served as acting director of the Asia Society's Contemporary Affairs Program. In terms of his education, he received his bachelor's degree from Rice University and M.A. in Regional Studies from Harvard University, and he was also a Thomas Watson Fellow at Yonsei University in South Korea. He is author of a number of books on Northeast Asia and Korean affairs. Most recently, his book, China's Rise and the Two Koreas, Politics, Economics, and Security, was published just this year by Lynn Reiner. So, Scott, as I said, we'll outline the report, and then we'll turn to Michael Finnegan, as you, somehow probably vaguely related to me, but not that we know of. In any event, we certainly come from the same clan, you can tell. He is a senior research associate now at the National Bureau of Asian Research here in Washington. Prior to joining NBR, he served for over 27 years as both a commissioned and non-commissioned officer in the United States Army, retiring at the rank of lieutenant colonel. And those of you, any of you who have worked USROK military-to-military cooperation relations, I'm sure know retired Colonel Finnegan now quite well, but I guess we should call him Mr. Finnegan. And but Mike has been an enormous resource for all of us learning about USROK military-to-military relations. His background is as a foreign affairs officer, specializing in Northeast Asia, and his most recent assignments, in addition to serving in the embassy in Seoul, was a director for Korea in the Office of the Secretary of Defense from 2003 to 2007, and his last assignment was a special assistant for regional strategy in the Office of the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Asia-Pacific Security Affairs. Mike also has a master's degree from Harvard in East Asian Regional Studies. As I said, he has been with the National Bureau of Asian Research for several months now. Yes. Right. So, and Mike is going to both comment on the report, but also set out a framework from a drawing on a paper that he has done recently on looking at some comparison between the USROK and the NATO and Japan as other alliance relationships, and sort of as a way to assess and think about the capacity and the potential of the USROK relationship. So we'll then turn to him for both that comment on Scott's report and also on some of these comparative analysis of alliance relationship, or looking at the ROK in somewhat of a comparative perspective. So let me turn the floor over now to Scott Snyder.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you, Steve, for that introduction, and also I want to thank CSIS for the opportunity to be involved with this project. Steve and Mike Green, Derek Mitchell, and Nick Cecchini gave, overall guidance, but I'm sure that any of the shortcomings of the report really fall to me. However, I think I'm pleased with how this came out. I also want to thank Allison Slack for all of her help and putting together research materials and also managing the production of the report. Obviously, this topic is not the sexy topic of the day. The issue of North Korea seems to overshadow even the alliance in some ways. But I think this is an important, very important issue for us to consider, especially when one steps back to reflect on the fact that the alliance between the United States and South Korea, in terms of the core objectives and mission, really hasn't changed very much at all over the course of now six decades. But South Korea has changed tremendously, as we all know, and the international context has also changed. South Korea is a modern global economy. It is a very healthy democracy. And the area of convergence in terms of our interests between the U.S. and South Korea, I think one can argue, has considerably broadened. And this means that the basis for common vision and joint action and the scope of application of that action have expanded from the peninsula to also extra-peninsula missions, including within East Asia and even out of area. And so I really believe that to write about the idea of a comprehensive alliance and to think about it, first of all, is a recognition of Korea's progress in its own development. And it is a representation of the fact that the U.S. and South Korea have a lot to offer together on issues and missions that go far beyond the specific original mission of trying to secure stability and prosperity on the peninsula. Just want to say on the front end that this particular report doesn't dwell on that sexy topic of North Korea very much, partly because our hope in putting together a kind of vision for the alliance was also to put together a set of missions that could be sustained and would be sustainable, you know, beyond the specific question of how things develop on in North Korea. Clearly, North Korea on a day-to-day basis and even for the near to midterm is going to be the critical issue that requires coordination for the two countries. But it turns out that increasingly there are many more things beyond North Korea, in addition to North Korea, that the United States and South Korea can do together. And so for that reason, this report attempts to give a kind of roadmap or a picture of what the other things that can be done using this alliance framework, but in order to build on it and broaden the partnership to achieve other objectives. Another area that this paper doesn't necessarily cover in any specific detail is about the specifics of the CHORUS FTA. That's also a very important issue, I think, for the U.S.-Korea relationship. I know that CSIS has another project looking at the CHORUS FTA led by Steve Schrage here at CSIS that I think is going to be making some very important arguments about how South Korea's leadership in the context of the G20 can be utilized as a tool for strengthening alliance cooperation as well. So I just want to acknowledge that the paper doesn't address those issues, but it does try to lay out a rationale and a vision for an expanded set of areas of cooperation. I'm going to, in fact, kind of invert the order of the of my presentation because I want to talk, first of all, about some of the specific areas where we think there can be a basis for expanded cooperation between the U.S. and South Korea. And in some cases, these are not necessarily new, but they haven't necessarily been systematized, and they haven't really been injected or incorporated into the DNA of our thinking about these activities as alliance activities. Rather, sometimes they seem to have been kind of added on activities that might have been done, you know, because of the alliance, but not necessarily done as part of a mutual commitment to alliance cooperation. And here I just want to start with Lee Myung-bak's own statement in the context of his inauguration last year, in which he very clearly indicated that he wanted to build he didn't use this phrase in the inaugural address, but it's become a kind of moniker, a global Korea. And in specific terms, in his inauguration address, you know, he mentions expanding Korea's commitment to peacekeeping, international peacekeeping. He mentions the idea of expanding South Korea's capacity in terms of committing overseas development assistance to meet the standards of the developed countries club for doing development. And this means, I think, a very rapid escalation, a doubling or tripling of South Korea's committed ODA over the course of the next few years. He also talks a little bit about Korea's commitments in the context of post-conflict stabilization. And so those are some, I think, areas where Korea now has the capacity to make commitments that can also be supported through cooperation in the context of the alliance. And we'll go through and maybe look in a little bit more detail about some of those global missions. Another aspect of Lee Myung-bak's own, I think, contribution is the commitment to the idea of a strategic alliance for the 21st century, which is what we heard last April in his first visit to the United States. And, of course, at that time, he was meeting with President Bush. It was the last year of the Bush administration. There had been talk about the possibility of some kind of joint vision statement. You know, that work, I think, remains to be done. And so I think another aspect of the development of this particular report was the idea that maybe it could be useful in terms of you know, kind of putting some meat onto the bones of what it means to have a strategic alliance for the 21st century. How can the foundation for cooperation be broadened beyond these, you know, catchwords of trust and values and peace that were named, but not necessarily very well explained in the context of the meeting last year. And here I just want to suggest that there's an opportunity for these two administrations now to really develop the template that we've laid out in terms of developing a broader foundation for alliance cooperation that you know, frankly, one aspect, I think, of what we wanted to achieve with this is to provide a political context for security cooperation, to think not only about the specific security issues that the U.S. and South Korea face on a day-to-day basis working together on military issues, but also think about how we can bolster a political context for that. And although we stopped short of suggesting this as a recommendation in the report, you know, what I like to really see is the Obama administration and the Lee administration joining together to do an exercise very similar to what we did in the mid-1990s in the context of the U.S.-Japan alliance, a kind of affirmation of the alliance and a delineation of how it can be strengthened in many different areas. And I just want to highlight two functional areas. We covered several other functional areas. But two functional areas that I think are kind of new that are going to be very, I think, important in a global context, but I think are worth noting. One is this issue of climate change, which is a new issue, I think relatively new on the global agenda. But I just think it's striking that Lee Myung-bak, first of all, is doing a lot of work on this issue domestically in South Korea. It hasn't yet necessarily been translated into South Korea's international policy in an active way, but this low-carbon green growth theme or Green Korea theme that is being emphasized in, domestically in South Korea is one that can be built on. I think that Lee Myung-bak signaled that he has that kind of vision in his comments following the G8 in Hokkaido last year, where he suggested that Korea could be a kind of bridge between the developed world and the industrialized world on issues related to climate change. Now, I think this is an issue that really could be fleshed out in much greater detail, but we've tried to signal that that is an area that could be important as a new area in terms of broadening U.S.-Korea cooperation. A second area that I want to really highlight is related to Korea's role in a non-proliferation context. And here I just want to note that the U.S. and South Korea are going to be renegotiating a bilateral nuclear cooperation agreement. The current one ends in 2014. The earlier agreement was negotiated in the early 1970s, and Korea has changed tremendously in terms of its own capacity. In the area of nuclear energy. It's now a nuclear energy producer and a nuclear energy exporter. And that carries with it new requirements in terms of how to think about non-proliferation and also nuclear cooperation. And one area that I think is going to be particularly interesting and maybe challenging in the context of the U.S.-South Korea bilateral nuclear cooperation agreement is going to be that South Korea also has some real challenges in terms of waste, and they've been experimenting with together with the United States in U.S. labs on a form of reprocessing called pyroprocessing. But that also is a little bit ambiguous right now in terms of how it is categorized as a potential proliferation issue. And so I think that this is going to be a particularly interesting and complicated issue for the U.S. and South Korea to manage under the Obama and Lee administrations. Now, what I want to do is to step back and just make a few points, first about the strategic value of the alliance, because I think that, you know, one of the things that we did was kind of go back and look at core issues in terms of how does the alliance serve the respective interests of the U.S. and South Korea. And here I just want to note that in not every case are the specific evaluations of how the alliance is valued specifically aligned with each other. There are a set of objectives that I think the alliance serves that serve the South Korean interest and then the U.S. interest, respectively. And so I just want to note, because I think it's important to go back to these core principles, that the alliance has served and I think can continue to serve to safeguard regional stability. And for South Korea, that defense commitment serves to deter aggression in the region. For the United States, I think the alliance continues to be a basis for U.S. engagement in Asia. And also it serves as a hedge against an uncertain future for China. It hedges against the possibility that China's rise may not be benign. The alliance also provides a vehicle by which the U.S. can safeguard its own interests regionally and globally in East Asia. And I'm going to kind of conclude with this, but I think another aspect of the paper that is important is really to try to think through, because the original form of the alliance was focused on what the U.S. could do for South Korean security, but it was in a very asymmetric situation. What are some principles that can provide a mutually beneficial rationale and a mutual commitment in terms of alliance cooperation? And so I just want to suggest a few principles, because I think that in many respects, in terms of thinking about a vision for the alliance, it's really these principles that serve as the basis for fashioning something in terms of our two countries' cooperation that can be sustainable over the long term. And here in the paper, what we explore is the idea that the alliance should be formed on the basis of a broad convergence of political interests, and that should include security components as one among many areas of cooperation, rather than as a primary focus of cooperation. I'm going to steal a line from Mike Finnegan because I've heard it so many times, that security, that the alliance has been the long pole in the tent. But if we're going to have a sustainable alliance cooperation going forward, it may be the case that we need other poles in the tent that can also serve as supports. A second principle that I explore in the paper is the idea that alliance cooperation, if it is to be sustainable, should reflect a mutual commitment in which needs and responsibilities are shared rather than being a one-way commitment in which there is an obligation by the United States to provide security without a reciprocal commitment to the partnership. And I guess that another way of putting it is that South Korea has a certain level of capacity both to secure its own defense and contribute more broadly. And so the idea of mutuality, I think, is probably very important in terms of thinking about sustainability. Another principle that we explore is really, I'm going to borrow from another colleague, Victor Cha, who talks about the intrinsic value of the alliance. The paper argues that alliance cooperation should be driven on the basis of an internal rationale based on common interests, and that it's possible to have that sort of sustainable division rather than necessarily being driven by a specific external threat. And then another principle that we explore is the idea that the alliance can fit into a regional context and that there can be cooperation with and among other alliances in the U.S. Set of alliance partnerships. And so it's possible to think about how trilateral cooperation can occur among the U.S., Japan, and South Korea, or also with Australia. And so, for instance, in the context of, you know, responding to humanitarian emergencies, South Korea could be more active. Or, for instance, the way that South Korea is taking part in the counterterrorism operation, anti-piracy operation off of the Somalia coast. And then the last one, I think, is maybe in a way the most, a very important one, and that is that we're in a situation at this stage where the United States is probably not, for the foreseeable future, going to be positioning itself as the sole provider of public goods. And South Korea is in a position to and has an interest, has its own interest in making a contribution. And so a comprehensive alliance can spread the risk and cost of provision of public goods and will be most effective when partners bring unique skills to bear in meeting common traditional or non-traditional security challenges. And then I just want to add one other thing. We talk about some of the obstacles, domestic political obstacles in South Korea and to a certain extent the U.S. in the paper. The one thing that I want to highlight is that there is a kind of interesting challenge in terms of perspective, and that is, you know, many of the things that I have listed as areas of cooperation, they make a lot of sense from a U.S. perspective because we have an outside-in perspective. As you look across the horizon at countries that have capacity, South Korea kind of stands out. But also it's important to recognize that Korea's view is a kind of inside-out view. Korea is surrounded by larger neighbors. If it were in Europe, it would stand out as a major partner. But given where South Korea is located, it seems to me that the alliance also serves an important role, especially if one thinks about this inside-out perspective that Korea has. The alliance serves an important role as a platform through which and by which Korea is able to do some of the work and tasks in terms of its own diplomatic profile that it might seek to pursue in a more effective way because of the fact that Korea's diplomacy and capacities, you know, can stand on the basis of that alliance cooperation. So I think with that last point, I'll turn it over.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Scott. Michael Finnegan.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve and Scott, for allowing me to be here today to participate in commenting on the report. And in some ways, being a cheerleader, I find very little to critique in the report, anything meaningful. Scott started by saying this is not the sexy topic of the day, that North Korea throwing a very predictable tantrum is the more compelling topic. I would say that this topic, though, is the baseline for our ability to respond to how North Korea acts. And therefore, this is the important topic of the day. It's important for us to consider how to keep this alliance strong in that respect so we can deal with North Korea, but also for us to consider how to evolve it in the future to a point where perhaps there is no North Korea. And in that sense, this report, I think, is a very, very important contribution to what I hope is an ongoing effort between the two governments to sort out a vision for the future. The report makes a very cogent argument for the need for a broader agenda for the political, economic, security, cultural discussion between the two countries. In my opinion, and in I think many observers' opinion, the U.S.-ROC agenda has been, over the last several years, fairly short, fairly constrained, and fairly stale. If you think about it, while there may have been many pieces in statements, the things that the government has spent most of its time on, the two governments, have been North Korea, alliance management, the FTA, a bilateral FTA, and visa waivers. This is not a global agenda. We need to move on to something bigger. Both countries are worthy of that. The development of an agenda that encompasses the full range of our political, military, economic, and cultural interests is needed, and that's what is outlined very well here in the report. Shared values should and must be able to be translated into shared goals, to shared policy approaches, and hopefully into meaningful cooperative actions on a habitual or, as Scott said, a systemic basis. I think the report points to to many, many areas where that type of cooperation can be built. Scott and I were at an earlier session today where a State Department colleague laid out cooperation between the U.S. and Iraq on financial stability, climate issues, and development assistance as being ripe for things that we should grab a hold of. And I think I agree with that, and those also happen to be in the report. Moving over to the vision, Scott makes the valid point about the long pole in the tent. For too long, the security part of this relationship has had to carry the weight of the relationship. We need to articulate a vision that is broad, that encompasses the entire relationship, but remains anchored in the security relationship. It has to, not to mix metaphors between poles and anchors, but needs to remain anchored in the security relationship. And why is that? Because that's what defines an alliance. That's what makes this different from a relationship, different from a partnership. So we can't lose sight of the security aspects. That vision, and many of us formerly in the government have argued for years why we need this vision, it provides the why for the relationship. It will tell our publics, very important, tell our legislatures why we have an alliance, what is the underpinning values of the alliance, and they'll be able to understand it and hopefully support it better. More importantly, what the vision will do is it will provide for our officials, for our military planners, that why that then allows them to determine the what and the how of the relationship. What are we going to do as partners and how are we going to do that? In other words, taking that vision and translating it into some type of operational guidance, not necessarily operational in the military sense, although that's part of it, but operationalizing that vision. Scott alluded to the process in Japan in the 90s, where we had a articulation of a vision, a declaration, and then followed up on guidelines. That's not necessarily a bad model. I would argue that we are a bit further than we were in Japan in the mid-90s. We are trying to take a very strong relationship from a security standpoint and move it to another level. Moving then to the security relationship, I would like to pull out three items that I gleaned from some research I did recently with Scott over at the Center for U.S. South Korea Policy. This was a comparison looking at NATO, looking at the U.S.-Japan relationship, and looking at the ROC relationship, and trying to figure out, as we move towards a new vision in the U.S.-ROC relationship, what are the things we need to be cognizant of that give strength to NATO and to the ROC today that we either want to strengthen or make sure that we at least don't throw out as we move into a new relationship. So I had three areas I'd like to just highlight. One is that a key driver for the development of the institutionalization and structure in both NATO and the ROC experience, but that was lacking in Japan and why we have very different types of alliances, was what I would term an operational imperative. NATO and Korea faced operational threats. They had to get the structure of the alliance, the operations of the alliance, right. Japan didn't. We never had to make the U.S.-Japan alliance functional operationally. So as the U.S.-ROC alliance moves, hopefully, beyond North Korea and looks for a new vision, we have to make sure that we're able to articulate the why of the military side of this. Why do we need this type of alliance? Because without articulating that why, that operational imperative, it will become very easy to start throwing out some of the structural pieces that really add the resilience and strength to the security part of the relationship. Again, one of the anchors of the overall relationship. Second point is that structure does matter. That one of the advantages of NATO and the ROC relationship has been the combined military structure. Perhaps more important than the combined military structure was the combined political structure that was embedded in NATO in particular, a little bit weaker in the U.S.-ROC relationship. What I saw as I looked at this was that the key to the strength of the U.S.-ROC relationship was not necessarily a combined headquarters, as in CFC, but the continuance of a combined defense system, which One is the plan, and two, which is what is outlined here in the report, continued combined defense system where we work together to defend the Republic of Korea. But more importantly, that combined defense system is directed by a strengthened SCM system. It's the civilian control system for the alliance that more effectively develops political and policy consensus and translates that into operational guidance for the military. That strong civilian-military linkage that already exists in the U.S.-ROK relationship needs to be continually fostered and strengthened as we move towards a new type of alliance. Final note, a third piece that I took away, was the civil support for the alliance. And this was striking to me when looking at NATO and understanding this piece of it. The vision must be understood and accepted by the public, by our legislatures. A key aspect of the NATO relationship that is unique in some ways is the existence of a very robust civil support mechanism that helps to ensure that the alliance message and vision is communicated well to the public and to the legislatures. We know it here in the United States as the Atlantic Council. There is a network of these in all NATO member countries as well as NATO partner countries. And it's built specifically to build public support for alliance goals. It goes beyond the U.S.-ROK Friendship Society or other people-to-people type mechanisms. And it provides meaningful support specifically for alliance goals in politics, economics, and national security. It supports the alliance as a political, economic, and national security entity. That is missing right now in the U.S.-ROK relationship. We depend on goodwill. We don't really do anything to foster it, and we need to be much more systemic about how we support the alliance. Just in wrapping up, I would say that the development and implementation of a new vision for the alliance, one that's broad but offers enough specificity to define what the alliance will be in the future, as outlined in this report, is something that has been very long needed. I think an open question here, though, and I'll throw this out for discussion, an open question is whether we can reach meaningful agreement on the details. Can the United States and the Republic of Korea come up with an alliance that really meets all of our needs from a security standpoint? Or are we destined to come to the lowest common denominator and have something that is not the type of alliance we need? I think one very interesting piece that we're going to have to wrestle with is how does the future alliance think about China? And with that, I'll.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Mike, and thank you also for emphasizing that the civil support dimension, and I hope we can come back to that, because one of the other things that Scott's report discusses, and an earlier report we had done here at CSIS, Jason Forrester had done on the dimension of the legislative branches talking to each other too, which is another thing that exists within NATO, the North Atlantic Parliamentary Assembly, and the U.S.-ROK linkages in the legislative exchanges and the interparliamentary exchanges, which are still there but growing, I think, a bit weaker and not nearly as many, particularly many members of U.S. Congress who understand the strengths and the diversity of the U.S.-ROK relationship, and a number of the people who were very interested, and a number of whom included some former Korean War veterans in the U.S. side, and who understood it well, but who are starting to pass from the scene. So I think it's very important that we also look at that dimension of this relationship in building support and maintaining support, broad political support, both among the popular. The broader populations, but among key legislative bodies. So, well, we have about 35 minutes for comments and questions, and hopefully we'll gin up some controversy. Maybe there's someone who has some questioning about some of the points we've made. Yes, and if I could just ask you to wait for a microphone, Dan is going to come up and just identify yourself, and if you have a comment or a question for a specific member of the panel, please do so, and otherwise we'll just try to respond to your comments.
My name is Tong Kim with the SAIS. I actually like to make a comment for both of you, Mike and Scott's presentations. I think we begin with the definition of what you mean by security alliance plus global partnership. That all began with the Lee Myung-bak's definition of strategic alliance. And I spent 2 hours with the architect of that concept of strategic alliance, Hyun-in Taek, who is now serving as the unification minister. He was the head of my research institute, where I also serve, still serving as a research professor. And his theory was very simple. He said he wanted to come up with something that had never existed in terms of foreign policy outlook for Lee Myung-bak. This began during his campaign. And he said, well, security is important, so we have to strengthen our military security alliance with the United States, plus something else that Scott elaborated on. And he said, since there was no such a concept before, he had to name it something. So he named it strategic alliance. And there was a lot of confusion here in town, but I think you said it right. It is basically security alliance plus global partnership. And I said, that's how it is understood. In Washington, he had no objection, but he was very unhappy with the fact that officials in the Lee Myung-bak government for the first year never really elaborated or defined what strategic alliance should mean. So, but I'm coming back to Scott's comment, I mean, your presentation. There's two components. One that Mike emphasized, the security aspect. It is a very good thing for this South Korean public. They will all support for it because North Korean threat still existed there and still exists today, even heightened today. And as Mike pointed out, the whole idea of alliance originated from because of North Korea, and it's still there. So for the South Korean public, it is good to know we're going to have a closer coordination with the United States, especially given in contrast with the fact that there was a lot of criticisms of how the Noh Moo-hyun government was dealing with the United States in terms of Mike was in all this, you know, so many years. But the thing is, the second part that Scott seems to be emphasizing, that are global partnerships, global cooperations. And let me give an extreme example. When President Bush was in Korea, and he was asked about what do you know about this strategic alliance, he said, well, something like there's a 21st century cooperation, something like helping we Korea and we work together for the education of children around the world. And I think this is the last thing Lee Myung-bak or his architect had in mind. But anyway, but the thing is, commitment to the peace, peacekeeping and more contribution to international projects and so forth that are not attractive to the Korean public because its expense is a cost to the Korea. It would be burden for Korea. It's politically not popular for Lee Myung-bak. So there's a dichotomy. So how are we going to reconcile that? Let me just stop there.
Okay. Thank you, Tom.
Well, I don't know if I can completely satisfy you on this, but it seems to me that one of the challenges that exists within South Korea, it's really a critical challenge for being able to proceed, is the issue of gaining support for this broadened agenda from the South Korean public. I've tried to lay out a set of reasons why I think that you know, this sort of vision would be necessary. But the debate in South Korea, I think, hasn't yet really, in a way, recovered from the polarization that developed over the course of the past few years, political polarization over issues related to the alliance. And so a lot of the things that that we were talking about that are new in terms of this partnership are specific things that it's still necessary for Lee Myung-bak himself to make the case that is in South Korea's interest to pursue it. I personally believe that the idea of a global Korea embodies a lot of that and that it has a broad public support. But when it comes to specific issues, one challenge is still the question of how to deal with situations when the return on investment is not tangible. I think that's hard in terms of South Korean public understanding yet and yet it is definitely a part, it's a component of that's related to South Korea's expanded scope of interest as a global leader, as a country that is now participating in leadership meetings like the G20 and playing a major role in other aspects of international governance, not only as a participant, but also in certain cases as the chair of those organizations, et cetera.
Okay, did you want
Dan, there's a question up here. Paul Chamberlain, and I'll come. Why don't we pull a couple of questions on the floor? Oh, thank you, Allison. Paul Chamberlain.
Thank you. Paul Chamberlain here. I want to compliment Scott on undertaking a report that's exceptionally important and I think very useful. A few years ago, I did a report comparing U.S. and Korean stated national interest, global national interest, and I was a little surprised at the high degree of compatibility that exists then and now among U.S. and South Korean national interest. And as Mike mentioned, and I think Scott mentioned, building an alliance on national interest is essential. Values are nice, they make it easier, but if you don't have compatible national interest, you don't have much to go on. The events of today point out North Korea is an enduring challenge to U.S. national interest and South Korean. And the more I think about it, the more I'm coming to the view that the only real solution is for the U.S. and South Korea to craft a strategy to expand national interest to include peaceful unification of Korea and to craft a strategy to move in that end in a nonviolent way. And the question that I have is the report written in such a way that that sort of development would factor in a logical, sensible way, or do you think that is being too short a poll?
Well, yes, sir, you were right here, and then the lady next to you. On the
Thank you. My name is Young Ri. I'm a former World Bank economist. I agree with two speakers' statement that we have to look at North Korea issue in the context of the frame of you developed here, and you have to look at the beyond North Korea in discussing South Korea-U.S. alliance. But I want to become a devil's advocate because North Korea issue is such a now pressing issue. Also, if you look back, the South Korea 60 years existence, one of the most successful country in the world in terms of development and democracy. So it's a successful the market economy and democracy. North Korea is one of the most really, I think, outlier in the global context in terms of failure. You know, this is the only country maybe except Cuba that resisting any market-oriented reform, and then now they want to play the game of nuclear and the missiles and other weapons of mass destruction. Of course, what North Korea become like that is not because of the South Korea and the U.S. alliance, it's because of the North Korea. But while South Korea and North Korea alliance are so successful in the development of the South Korea, why that alliance failed in inducing North Korea in giving up nuclear and then pushing market-oriented reforms. There we have to look at the short-term issue and the long-term issue. Clearly, inducing this to North Korea now, it looks like it's a long-term issue in both market-oriented reform and then giving up nuclear weapons. But in terms of alliance, really, because each government, you know, in Korea, 5 years term, and here U.S. 4 years presidential election. So really, you don't look at the long-term alliance. Maybe that may be one of the reasons. If you go back to, say, 1994, the agreed framework that was purely looking at dealing with the pushing North Korea, giving nuclear, and then, you know, you give some energy support, etc. But there's not much market-oriented reform pushing. The same thing with the six-party process. Now both failed. Now North Korea has more weapons than before, and they become more isolated in the world. Now what we do? We have a new two governments in South Korea and the U.S. We have to look at the very long-term strategy.
Okay.
But how your framework will help in dealing with that kind of a strategy.
All right, good. Thank you very much. And then let me take one more question, and then we'll go to the back of the room. The lady here just on the left, my left.
Hi, my name is Grace Kong. First, I want to thank all of the panelists for your insightful remarks, and congratulations to Scott in particular for what looks to be an excellent report. My question to Scott is, do you see a strengthened and broadened alliance between the U.S. and ROK as leading to a regional security structure as a way for the alliance to address how it thinks about China, and as a way to perhaps make a broadened U.S.-ROK alliance more attractive to the ROK domestic audience?
Thank you very much, and hopefully I'll just embroider on that a little bit. Scott Natsky, if you'd also, and Michael also, if you could touch on a little bit about the ROK government's concerns about the regional role for the alliance and some of the limitations that exist within that. So you want to start with Paul Chamberlain's question first, or you can take them in any order. And
okay. Well, with regard to explicitly saying, first of all, I think that the U.S. and South Korea do share an interest in peaceful Korean unification. It's true that it's not necessarily always been made explicit as an objective, but it certainly is, a shared desire. Whether or not there might be ways to operationalize cooperation on that, I think that the challenge is really in terms of aligning priorities. That's not the focus in terms of this overall paper, primarily because, I think that the original, discussion of, future rationales for the alliance included the question of, is it possible to imagine an alliance post-unification? In which case, if the paper had been premised on achieving that objective, it in fact wouldn't answer the question of what would be the shared interests that might sustain the alliance aside from or beyond North Korea. So for that reason, I think that we tried to frame the paper more broadly. For a long time, with regard to the second questioner, I would argue that the alliance has actually been quite a success because its objective has been deterring North Korea. The objective of the alliance, the specific objective of the alliance has not been to try to promote North Korean reform necessarily. And in fact, what occurred to me in listening to what it would take to that particular objective, to achieve that particular objective, it kind of raises the question of, do you mean that we should approach North Korea the same way that we approached Iraq? I guess it's a fair question that you can ask, whether maybe North Korea should have been the focus instead of Iraq. But right at this point, it seems like the issue of reform and democratization wasn't necessarily the rationale that has been most acceptable or convincing, sort of ex post facto, in that case. With regard to China, it seems to me the argument that I try to make in the paper is that the alliance has an intrinsic mission that is not dependent necessarily on what other countries do, but certainly the actions of other countries can influence how the alliance responds. So the idea of having a structure in place to, you know, promote a common interest in peace and prosperity, you know, it's just a mechanism. The purpose of that mechanism will depend on what are the perceived challenges to freedom and prosperity more broadly. You know, essentially I'm trying to make the argument that what we do in the alliance shouldn't be driven solely by the question of what happens in North Korea or what happens in China, but what happens there can influence how the alliance is configured to respond to perceived threats. I think that let's see, a regional role for the alliance. What I argue in the paper is that there is an opportunity for expanded interactivity with other alliance structures. It falls short of making any kind of recommendation about a regional alliance structure. It seems to me that this whole issue of regionalism in East Asia is going to continue to be shaped on an ad hoc basis by developments. It seems to me that there are some regional cooperation structures that are attempting to, you know, bring various countries together for, you know, more intensive interdependence. There are others that are playing a kind of hedging role against possible negative developments, and it'll really be the developments themselves that will shape the question of which of those sorts of regional structures end up being empowered or diminished over the course of time.
Did you want to come in on this?
Go back very quickly to Tong's comment about the strategic alliance, and I think there were two problems with the way that was rolled out, and I think those problems still haunt us today. One, it was not very well communicated to the alliance partner. Rolled it out, and a lot of people left wondering what it was. Well, once we unpacked it, it made a lot of sense, and I think that's reflected in Scott's analysis of it, that it fits what we're talking about here. The bigger problem, though, is it hasn't been sold to the ROK people, to the Korean people. Arguably, cooperation in Afghanistan fits into that global partnership piece, whether it's, you know, military cooperation or development assistance cooperation. Well, we're not doing very well on that account. So I think there's a lot of salesmanship that needs to go on in Korea. And I think that the fact that that hasn't been sold very well tells us that we still have that challenge with selling a new vision for the alliance. To get to Paul's question and a little bit to the gentleman here, on a longer-term view and unification, I think it would be interesting to see the reaction if we came out with a stated alliance policy for unification. I don't think we'd ever get there. I think a lot of people would, in the process, would stop us from doing that because it would obviously shut down a lot of the dialogue that people hope to have with North Korea. But I think what would be more interesting, actually, is just for the two governments to have the discussion. What does unification mean? What are our goals? How do we reinforce each other? Because I, for one, have never been a party to an honest discussion between us on what unification means. And I've been doing Korea inside the government for a little while. So I think that would be an interesting discussion to have. To the regional question, I'll start just by an anecdote. Several years ago in discussing a new vision for the alliance, I made the comment, not well thought out maybe, I used the phrase, we should talk about regionalizing the relationship. Now, what I meant was, how does the relationship apply to regional problems? The way it was taken was that I wanted to take our partner and drag him around the region to do the U.S. bidding. And that is a dynamic that we have to fight against. I think, you know, when we look at the three pieces of a new vision for the alliance, a peninsular, a regional, and a global aspect to it, the regional is actually the hardest piece. That is going to be the hardest piece to come down. And just go back and look at how the question of strategic flexibility several years ago was, how that blew up in the relationship and haunted us for several years when all we were talking about was the ability of U.S. forces to be able to leave and come back to the peninsula if they were needed. Korea arguably benefits from strategic flexibility because that's what allows us to bring forces to the peninsula in a crisis. But it blew up on us because it was seen. I mean, I remember one of the famous comments in the newspaper was we were trying to create USFK along with our Korean partner was going to become a regional flying squad and was going to fly around in the region and take care of all the hot spots. We've got when we deal with the regional aspect of the relationship,
dragging Korea into a war over Taiwan.
Exactly. When we deal with the regional aspect of the relationship, we're going to have to fight against that perception. And that takes the ROC government being able to sell it to their people, which takes me back to my first comment.
I think if I could just mention just a little bit on the regional role, I think I agree with both what Mike and Scott said about this being in some ways the hardest. But you could also see, and borrowing a little bit from Mike's benchmarking against NATO, if you look at the way in which sometimes issue-forcing events can cause alliance relationship, alliance transformation in some ways. And NATO in 1995 did not do peacekeeping, but suddenly there was a screeching war on its periphery, and there was genocide happening, and someone had to act. And so suddenly NATO began to develop a peacekeeping capability. I think you could also see in some ways, and let's hope it doesn't go this way, but it could. There's been a lot of discussion about this, and it's too bad Chaz Freeman left because we've had some discussions about this with him about instability on the Korean Peninsula, how that might lead to some development of regional cooperation over how to stabilize the North. And this is something that has been danced around among the various governments concerned. There's been a lot of interest in how the six-party talks could maybe serve as a mechanism to manage just exactly that kind of scenario. So you could imagine, I think, over time, and maybe driven by events that no one really wants to have unfold, but just might happen. And so, how do you manage this? And so, I think this is one thing that, and Scott alluded to it in his remarks, that we do need to. I think there was a lot of discussion about the need that we do need to talk somehow in first a US-ROK context, then US-ROK, perhaps some of the other parties in the six-party talks, and then directly with the North about how, with the Chinese about how we would deal with instability in the North. So, but let me take a few questions in the back. Brad Glosterman, I saw you've been waiting patiently, and pass the microphone.
Okay. Scott, nice job. Mike, as well. Two questions, if I may. While I agree to a point about the need to sell the alliance to the publics, I'm wondering that sort of there's something artificial about that. And I guess what I'm wondering, Scott, is to what degree does your research on national identity in South Korea fit in with this longer-term US-ROK alliance? I mean, it strikes me that we have to go beyond salesmanship, that there has to be a fundamental identification of interest. And how does the U.S. vision of this US-ROK interest align with the broader sense of evolving sense of identity in South Korea? Second, to sort of look at the regional context, I guess I'm wondering, or it seems to me that we're on a cusp, if you will, at which we're able to consider our alliances in isolation from each other. If you look at the longer-term trends, it strikes me that there's lots of cross-cutting factors that would oblige us to be considering them together. So I'm wondering, at what point do we just need to start taking the US-ROK alliance, for example, within the context of the US-Japan alliance, and start planning across the board, not only just sort of bilaterally or trilaterally, but actually integrating the two and thinking about them in a very structurally integrated sense.
Hi, Mark Mannion with the Congressional Research Service. Quick question and a follow-on comment to what Brad just said. The question is, you both emphasized the importance of selling this vision to the two publics, and I'm wondering to what extent you think the fate of CORUS will affect this, particularly if, in a negative scenario, if CORUS isn't brought up or is not passed here in the United States. What about the negative spillover that could have on the security side of the alliance? And the comment is just, following on what Brad said, it did sort of strike me, at least in your remarks, Scott, that, there's almost a sense that this is the expanding the alliance for the sake of the alliance. I know you talked about interest and whatnot, but then you were sort of trying to downplay the China angle. But it seems to me if you take if you strip North Korea and you strip China out of the equation, what are you left with? You're left with what Michael said, which is a partnership, not necessarily alliance. So I'm just confused. Maybe it was just the way I heard your remarks rather than the way you presented them. But if you could elaborate on that, that would be helpful.
The gentleman right here.
My name is Yongwan Keel, Georgetown University visiting scholar. I have listened to similar presentations in the last 2 or 3 months on the new beginnings of alliance and, let's say, American Century report where Pacific Forum was involved in, and this one. So that this one, I get the impression that it is more kind of a vision statement as to how ROK and the U.S. must move forward. And Scott, in your presentation, you introduced the notion of symmetry and asymmetry. To me, alliance is a defense formal agreement between sovereign nation states to defend themselves. But as I mentioned by previous commentator, you are more talking about the partnership of how we move from here to there. Do you think that South Korea and the U.S. can really attain the level of, let's say, equality, symmetry? It seems to me that South Korea needs more U.S. commitment to defend it, you know, peninsula, let's say, difficulty, rather than just going to the level of symmetric partnership in the future. I'd like to hear your comments on that. Thank you.
Thanks. Scott, you want
to? Okay. Well, three very interesting sets of comments. I'll start with, I mean, Brad is basically asking me to give another presentation on another project, and I'm going to try to resist that, except insofar as to suggest that if you look at how Koreans see themselves and what they're proud of, and we've done research on this, what you get on the basis of interviews, at least among elites, is a strong sense of pride in South Korea's own accomplishment as a country that has democratized and as a country that has industrialized. And additionally, the effect of those accomplishments has been to make South Korean and American societies and politics actually more similar today than they have ever been. And so it's on the basis of that social structure, which, you know, from my perspective, you know, there's a broader sense of shared values, but the important thing is that those values are shaping interests in global stability because of South Korea's export dependency, in perpetuation of a certain, you know, conditions for promoting, fighting against sources of instability around the world. You know, Korea has a range of interests that goes beyond the peninsula now. It's really a regional and global set of interests. And so the hard part, which we've, you know, touched on in, you know, several cases, is trying to, get that to be part of the Korean consciousness or recognition, because there's this lag. There's what the Koreans like to call the frog in the well kind of view, where, in fact, the Korean public, I think, really doesn't realize the extent or reach of Korea's own interests yet. And that's really the challenge, I think, that Mike's been talking about, you know, education that the Korean government has. You know, the other thing that I would point to is recent public opinion polls, which show, I think, strong support for continued close alliance cooperation with the United States, following a kind of, you know, difficult period, 2002-2003. In terms of the issue of integration of alliances, well, I mean, Japan-Korea relations presents, I think, a significant practical obstacle to imagining
very much integration, but I do think that there is a greater opportunity for interaction and interoperability to address specific types of missions. And I think that that is something that can be encouraged. But, you know, as a from a political perspective, there's still, I think, significant obstacles to the idea of the alliances being integrated into any kind of regional approach. The CORUS FTA question is a very interesting one. It's one that I've struggled, it's been a persistent topic of discussion over the course of the past year. There are some people who will tell you that if the FTA ratification fails, then it's going to be catastrophic for the alliance. I don't think I'm in that camp. I think that it would be a significant blow to the opportunity to develop a greater sense of partnership and a broadened sense of cooperation between the two countries. It would be a setback, but I don't think that it. But I think it's a setback that that we would be able to survive. With regard to the issue of the question of whether we're trying to argue for the alliance's sake, one argument or one issue that I struggled with in the course of putting together this report was, in fact, whether or not it should be a comprehensive alliance or it should be a kind of global alliance partnership. And it turns out that Koreans don't like the word partnership as much as they like the word alliance. Whereas I think from a U.S. perspective, if you think about NATO, you think about partnership. Alliance is, a part of that, but it goes beyond. And really, in the paper, what we're trying to talk about is how a convergence of interests has established the basis for U.S. and South Korean political cooperation that includes the alliance, but goes beyond that in various areas. In many respects, what this paper really does is to, benchmark U.S.-EU cooperation in order to identify specific political interests that can be incorporated into the U.S.-Korea relationship because Korea's ready at this stage to join in that type of cooperation. And then I guess, the last question, let me just say that when I used the words symmetry and asymmetry, I didn't have in mind any particular international relations theory connotation. And I'm not arguing that there needs to be symmetry as a precondition for us working together. It seems to me that by its nature, the relationship is going to have strong elements of asymmetry. But it's considerably less than it had been in the past, and the fact that that asymmetry has lessened is one of the conditions that has helped create some new opportunities.
Just maybe before I turn to Mike for the last word, I just want to also mention one thing that struck me too is that we didn't mention it yet today, but one thing that did resonate in some of these discussions we had about it's the alliance relationship is about a convergence of interests and many common interests, but also a convergence of values, and this idea of a partnership that is also about protecting those values from anyone that would, this alliance relationship is about not defending against a specific threat. In other words, if the North Korean threat goes away, if China turns out to be a peaceful neighbor for the indefinite future, it doesn't mean the alliance necessarily goes away. It means that it still has enduring value because it's about promoting and protecting the values and interests that the two governments feel that they want to work together on, both more broadly in the region and even more globally. And so I think it's that notion that was very much undergirding some of the discussions we had about why still an alliance, particularly in the context of if there is, although sadly, as we reminded again today, the threat from the North is not necessarily dissipating. But Michael, I'll give you the last word.
Okay. Just very quickly, two quick points on CORUS. I agree with Scott. I think if CORUS fails, it is a blow to the alliance. It hurts the alliance. The alliance survives. I would say though that the type of agenda that's laid out here in this report becomes incredibly more difficult for the public in South Korea in particular to accept, I think. On the point of expanding for the sake of expanding, and I'll tie it to the mutuality piece of this, this is something that we're going to have to wrestle with as we look to define a new vision for the alliance. And as we go into this exercise, we need to be prepared. We may not like what we find out. We may not be able, and this is what I was getting to earlier, we may not be able to achieve the type of consensus that we want, and we may find that we have to come to a lower common denominator. But having said that, that type of honest discussion is needed, because then we both understand what the alliance is, what it isn't, and we can plan accordingly. But I think we do need to go into this understanding, go in with a little bit of trepidation that we may not like everything we find out in a discussion about what this alliance is in the future, because I think we do have some different views.
Thank you very much. Well, I want to thank, first of all, Michael Finnegan for joining us today and for his insightful comments. I want to also congratulate Scott with a bit of detachment from this, having been just an advisor to him, for a superb and I think truly a comprehensive report. I hope all of you will have a chance. There are copies available if you haven't received them already. There are copies available out there for you. And just a word of commercial message, I just wanted to let those of you know that or are interested in this issue. We talked a little bit about the economic dimension of this. Our colleague Stephen Schrage from the Scholl Chair here in international business at CSIS has done another paper on not quite this detail, but on the U.S.-ROK economic relationship and both the future of the FTA, but also, as Scott alluded to, the U.S.-ROK partnership on global economic issues in the context of next year's ROK lead. ROK will be the lead country in the G20. So he explores some ideas on how that will be another opportunity to advance the U.S.-ROK partnership both regionally and globally within the G20 context. And so we'll be sending out a notice, and if you want to be alerted to that, please let us know. You can leave a note with Allison on your way out. And also, you can expect a growing number of projects here at CSIS on Korean affairs in the coming months, and more to be said about that. And lastly, again, our thanks to the Korea Foundation for their support of this effort, and we look forward to seeing you in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.